We're going to be looking at three kinds of history, three stages. Formative history is basically the first 14 billion years. Biblical history is especially from Genesis 2 onward when people begin to become involved with it. And current history, especially since the New Testament times, since the ending of the New Testament. This talk will be an introductory overview, a big picture outline of some major themes. And the abstract summarizes what I want to say. It's in your main booklet there, in the R's. And so what I'm going to do is just go through it one point at a time to expand. Abstract begins, during history in the Bible, divine action is usually natural appearing and occasionally miraculous appearing. This is a fact, and we can all agree. But it's followed by my claim, and some of you may not agree. It seems reasonable to expect, unless there is strong counter evidence, that both modes of action are still used now and were used during the formative history of nature. So my claim is that, by analogy, we should expect that both modes of action, producing events that appear natural and appear miraculous, were used during formative history of nature. This argument by analogy certainly is not conclusive, but I think it does provide theological support for a theory of progressive creation. I'll come back to this later. First, let's look at natural process. What do we mean when we say that something occurred naturally? One answer is common, but it's wrong. In a theistic worldview, natural does not mean without God. Why? Because God designed nature, created nature, constantly sustains nature. And it does not mean without control, because God can guide nature, so one natural result occurs instead of another natural result. So God is actively involved in natural process in four ways: design, creation, sustaining, and guidance. One point I want to emphasize is that for theism, even though a sustaining of the universe is necessary, it's not sufficient. Let's compare theism with deism. In deism, in the beginning, God actively designs and creates the universe, but then God is passive, taking a hands-off approach by just letting it run. But theism emphasizes the active control by God. Earlier I said that God can guide nature. That's a principle of faith, and we can all agree. But when we ask, does God control nature, we'll have disagreements. And I'm not even sure what I think about this. Does God control always, usually, seldom, or never? And at a particular instant, is there control of some events in the universe, or all events, or none? And when there is control, is it total, as in determinism, or only partial? We know that God can guide, but we wonder whether God does guide and in what ways. The fact that God can control everything leads to a really difficult theological question. Why is there evil and suffering if God is loving, so he should want to prevent the suffering, and is powerful, so he could prevent it? Like all of you, I don't have a good answer, but I think the absence of answers that we consider satisfactory is due to our own limited perspective. We find it difficult to understand the time dimension of God's perspective, which includes life after death, and the generality of God's perspective, which includes everyone, not just me and my small circle of friends. Then there's the educational value. I don't think we fully appreciate the educational value of living by faith in a world filled with drama and danger, while trusting that everything God wants to control really is under his control. Back to the abstract. Applying these principles leads to interesting perspectives on important questions. One practical question is, if natural means with God involved, how should this affect our actions, the way we live? At the end of the talk is the most important action, but we'll begin with an easy one. It's obvious that we should avoid saying that natural means without God. But that's not enough. We also shouldn't imply it, and we shouldn't allow it. For example, Alan Harvey describes a scorekeeping system as common even though it's wrong. In this way of scoring, if it's a miracle, we give credit to God. If it's natural, it counts against God as something God did not do, since it would happen anyway, even if God did not exist or was not active. The difficulty is that people tend to assume the scorekeeping system, which makes sense for non-Christians, but it also occurs for Christians even though it's unbiblical. Therefore, we have to explicitly deny this, call attention to it, and do whatever we can to be educationally effective to change the way people think when they're thinking about natural process. Another application. In the abstract, they say theistic evolution can be an authentically theistic creation theory. But many in the Christian community, especially those who are most vocal in the origins debates, disagree with this in their declarations and their implications. And that's unfortunate. But I do have a tough question. Even though theistic evolution can be authentically theistic, we should ask, to make it theistic rather than deistic, what views of natural process are required? Is the sustaining of nature sufficient? Or is a divine control of natural process also necessary? Earlier I talked about the characteristics of control and reached the conclusion that I don't know. But I do think the level of control is somewhere above zero. And I'm wondering if advocates of theistic evolution will agree and will emphasize this when describing their own views. When we look at a theory of evolutionary creation, we can ask two questions, one scientific, the other theological. Scientifically, can natural process produce all of the complexity we observe? Theologically, can natural process achieve the goals of God? First, there's a question about Howard Van Til's RFEP, robust formational economy principle. It seems that God designed nature to operate smoothly. What this means is that nature was designed so everything could happen by natural process. The first question is scientific, and it's about that principle. It seems that God designed nature to operate smoothly without miraculous intervention, so it would be self-operating. But did he also design nature to be self-assembling? After the initial design and creation, will the universe naturally self-assemble into complex physical and biological structures? Van Til says yes, and we can study this claim using science. In astronomy, we see the wonderful ways that natural process leads to the formation of stars, as described by Deborah Harsma last night and this morning. For astronomical evolution, natural process does seem to produce self-assembly. But when we examine the origin of life by chemical evolution, the scientific conclusion might be different. Why? When we look at the simplest life, it's not simple. There's a high degree of complexity, and it's just the right kind of complexity. But if we compare what's needed for life, a lot, with what's available from natural process, seems to be not very much. A self-assembly of life doesn't seem very probable. Is the universe designed so total self-assembly is possible? Maybe, maybe not. But we can certainly say as Christians with confidence that a totally natural self-assembly isn't necessary because God can do miracles. Also, there may be an essential tension between assembly and operation. Maybe it's not possible to design a universe for optimal operation and also self-assembly. Walter Bradley illustrates this by asking us to imagine a car designed so it can change its own spark plugs. We respond by saying, why bother? We don't need this because we can change the spark plugs. God doesn't need to design a universe to be self-assembling because he can put in whatever is not needed, wasn't there. More important, designing a car for self-maintenance might reduce its performance in other ways that are more important. and would not lead to an optimal car. In a similar way, maybe designing for partial self-assembly, not total self-assembly, is the best way to get an optimal universe. Self-assembly is a scientific question with a little bit of theology thrown in. We can also ask a question that's mainly theological. In a theory of theistic evolution, what makes it theistic instead of deistic? In a totally deistic evolution, when the level of theistic guidance is zero, will this unguided natural process achieve the goals of God? When thinking about this question, we need two sub-questions. First, how precise were the goals of God? Did God want humans with the exact characteristics we have? Physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual? Or would it be enough to just produce any creatures that are complex and interesting? Second, how predictable are the results of unguided evolution? What would be the results of different evolutionary histories? If we run the tape 100 times, would the results be identical, fairly similar due to convergence, or very different due to divergence? Now, back to the abstract and two modes of action on my own view of origins. I ask in the abstract, is the theory of creation by miraculous appearing genetic modification, analogous to the healing in Acts 3, a theologically and scientifically plausible theory? When we look at the theology and science, yeah, this is a plausible theory, and I think it's most likely to be correct. That's where I would place my bets. First, consider theology. When we study the Bible, we should look at details and also the big picture. At the level of details, we can look at specific passages, for example, by trying to determine the meaning of creation words in Genesis 1. Do these words describe creation by natural process, miraculous action, some of each, or is the meaning unclear? We can also look at the big picture, the overall flow of action in the Bible, and here we see the two modes of action, usually natural, occasionally miraculous. By analogy, we can say since there are two modes of action in the biblical history of humans, maybe we should expect two modes of action in the formative history of nature. Let's look at a timeline for the lame man in Acts 3. He's born, leads a natural life for about 40 years, miraculous healing of his leg, and he continues his natural life. Maybe this timeline for the lame man in salvation history is also used for some organisms during formative history. For one or more organisms, sometime during its natural life, there might have been a miraculous genetic change. Change might be a set of systematic macro mutations to produce new features, like birds that can fly, or structures that are irreducibly complex. I won't go into the details here, but a theory of creation by genetic modification is very different scientifically than a theory of old Earth independent creation, in which a new species is produced from scratch, so it would not necessarily have any continuity with its ancestors. With genetic modification, there is genetic continuity. So evidence for common descent would be expected in agreement with natural evolutionary theory, and the main challenges to evolution would be questions about rates of change and irreducible complexity. At this point in the abstract, I'll depart from it briefly for a comment about flexible open science. If we want to find truth about the history of nature, we should abandon a rigid methodological naturalism. We should begin with naturalism by assuming that natural process did it, but we should be flexible, willing to change this conclusion if it doesn't seem justified when we look at the scientific evidence and logic. In some of my web pages, I look at open science, and my goal is to encourage careful thinking. Based on my own experience in careful thinking, it seems that when we study the option of rejecting a rigid methodological naturalism, the closer we look, the better it looks. Back to the abstract. Why isn't divine action more obvious more often? If God created using miraculous action, why is there any appearance of an all-natural process of gradual evolution? Why aren't the miracles more obvious? It's a good question, and we can ask similar questions about events in the Bible. After the resurrection of Jesus, why did he not appear in downtown Jerusalem? Why doesn't God give everyone a Damascus Road experience? It worked for Paul. Why not for the rest of us? The outline of what seems to be a good answer comes from C.S. Lewis in Chapter 8 of Screwtape Letters. The explanation from Lewis is that in order to educate us, to help us learn how to live by faith, God doesn't want to overpower us by making his actions too obvious. Instead, he produces a balance of evidence with some reasons to believe and some reasons not to believe. So we're not overpowered. We're free to develop a desire for God, and we really want to build a relationship with God. And talk this morning, again from C.S. Lewis by way of William Keel. Lewis talks about our Christian beliefs being intellectually possible, but not intellectually compulsive. And I think that's a good description. Remember earlier I said two modes in the Bible leading to two modes of informative history was supported, but I didn't think it was any kind of conclusive proof. One argument against my analogy is a question about the functions of a miracle in salvation history. But I think about two different functions. One is to accomplish something, to heal the lame man. In biblical history, lots of things like that. Informative history might have been to produce the first life, produce a certain kind of complex structure in biological organisms. So that's one function. Another one would be to serve as a sign that would affect the balance of evidence that I just talked about. And probably talk about this during the discussion. The abstract also makes several suggestions about terminology. To avoid a reinforcement of the unfortunate assumption that natural process occurs without God, should we avoid a dichotomy of natural versus supernatural? And should we avoid the use of naturalism to mean a universe without God? Now look at four terms that can lead to wrong thinking. First, when we contrast natural with supernatural as an either-or dichotomy, here's what happens. If supernatural means God is involved, contrasting term, natural, must mean God is not involved. We get wrong thinking. Second term, similar difficulty occurs when we use naturalism to mean a universe without God. Because if naturalism means a universe without God, maybe natural means an event without God. But if we don't say naturalism, what are the alternatives? Another common term for universe without God is materialism. This is better since it tends to produce fewer wrong ideas about divine action. But materialism has another common meaning: too much focus on earthly pleasures, especially by gaining wealth and material possessions. Because Christians should also oppose this type of materialism, when we criticize materialism, there are two possible meanings and thus a potential for confusion. Here's what I suggest. If intended meaning is that only nature exists, why don't we call it natureism? If the only thing that exists is nature, it's naturism, not naturalism. Why should we add an extra syllable that isn't needed, especially when it leads to wrong thinking? Third, I don't like the term natural history. Again, the difficulty is two meanings. First, natural can mean pertaining to nature, and in this sense, natural history is okay. But the most common meaning of natural is normal appearing and non-miraculous. So the most common meaning of natural history is a history with only normal appearing process. And this is not okay because it's a conclusion that closes minds when we should be asking questions with an open mind. To avoid this implication, instead of natural history, we should say the history of nature that is neutral. Fourth, we have God of the gaps. What's wrong with this term? It's overpopulated with meanings. Inevitable result is confusion. So if we want to avoid confusion, we should avoid this term. For details about this claim, for my explanation of why God of the gaps should be eliminated from our vocabulary, and for more details about everything else in this talk, you can go to that URL. And near the middle of the page is a link for this talk, Two Modes of Divine Action. Finally, the most important application. In the abstract, I end by asking, what important application or implications does the supernatural control of natural process have in daily life? Imagine that we really believe this with all of our heart. What difference would it make? If God is actively involved in natural process, then God is involved in every aspect of our lives, every day, even when it isn't obvious. Therefore, we should make this understanding a part of the way we live. We should pray for God's control in all of the natural, normal-appearing events that fill our lives, and we should expect these prayers to be answered.
Your attention here to the web page where you can get his paper along with other materials. Questions for Craig?
Can you do that?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like you to address the objection you cited against the analogy between the miraculous and the natural.
The objection that during biblical history, one of the major functions is to show people that there is a God and that He is working in these prophets and so on.
Such a point is made about this in Scripture. I mean, the whole structure of John's Gospel is built around signs.
Well,
so you have not only the signs signifying the deity of Jesus, but also the element of God demonstrating His compassion. And all of that depends upon the existence of conscious beings who appreciate and are convinced by these things.
Well,
none of that's around during formative history. So
are we not conscious beings now? Should I repeat the question?
Yes, please.
The question basically is a very good explanation of the importance of, in the Bible, of the sign function of miracles, especially during the Gospel of John, for example. This was done so that you will know that Jesus is our Savior and so on. I guess the major, that's a really good argument, and I respect it. It is an argument for the function of miracles in biblical history. It is not an argument against the function of against also having miracles in formative history. I think the other, well, first of all, we do have conscious beings now, us, other scientists who are studying the universe, who really appreciate the bigness of astronomy and the wonderful way that everything is put together so it works, so we get sunshine with gravity and nuclear forces being in just the right balance and everything like that, to the really tiny, the way it works in physiology. But it may not be self-assembling. Maybe it is necessary for God to do miracles, just like the car with the spark plugs that can change themselves. Why bother? Maybe a universe that is really designed wonderfully in all these other ways, should it be self-assembling? I mean, life is really complicated. It doesn't appear, Terry will disagree with this probably, but it doesn't appear that the science is against it right now. They can be real optimistic. I think there's that we can appreciate it now, and also it just may be necessary.
Can
it looks
I
like.
Follow up on that. I very briefly. I'm not saying that this is not possible. I'm just saying that an argument from analogy requires that the two situations be analogous. And you have pointed out an exceedingly important difference between human history and formative history. And so